Hi, Catherine. And I think maybe we'll just kick off by looking at this so-called scandal, although the facts are pretty clear about what's going on, except that the press doesn't seem to really quite want to go there, about the announcement by Boris Johnson last week in the Commons that he is rather sceptical about Keir Starmer, the leader of the opposition, because he was in charge of the Crown Prosecution Service when they, well, depending on who you ask, between three or four times were presented with clear evidence by the police, by Surrey police and by Sussex police, after interviews with people who had been molested by Jimmy Savile, obviously in older years. I mean, if you go back, it was a time when there was a bit of a resurgence in interest in the idea that there might be, you know, protected paedophiles in the British establishment. And so none of those three or four prosecutions, which seemed as if they should go ahead, actually did go ahead. And this was the decision of the Crown Prosecution Service, which Keir Starmer, the now Labour leader, was running at the time. There was an inquiry by Alison Levitt QC when Savile died, who looked into why it was that none of these prosecutions had taken place. And that was really only prompted by the scandal at Newsnight, which it was a colleague of mine, Liz McKean, who was Newsnight's social affairs correspondent. She had interviewed some of Savile's victims, you know, because obviously this is a horrific thing to have to go through on camera, especially to relive it. And then she was told by the Newsnight editor that that program or that that piece would not go out because because the BBC were doing a Jimmy Savile special that Christmas. And so she was just totally disgusted by that, the idea that, you know, you had to protect this guy even after he's dead. Well, you know, the reason he was protected whilst he was alive was, first of all, fear of libel actions. You know, he was wealthy, he was powerful, he's well connected. And so broadcasters were afraid to publish things about Savile. But anyway, the point being that that article as well was suppressed. It was written up by Miles Goslett about what had happened at Newsnight. And as all that finally came out through the Oldie magazine after about 6 months, Miles Goslett had tried to get the Newsnight story published in all the major newspapers and eventually got it out in the Oldie, which was run by Richard Ingrams, you know, the ex-private eye guy who was kicked out during the arrival of Ian Hislop at Private Eye. And and lo and behold, about 6 months after the publication of that, Richard Ingrams was booted out as editor of the Oldie. So, you know, there's a whole kind of cascade of protection, it seems, still, you know, still ongoing around the whole Jimmy Savile case, mainly because of his incredibly powerful BBC and royal connections. When Alison Levitt QC did her inquiry when Savile died into why he wasn't prosecuted, and after the Newsnight debacle, she also dug up the facts that all of the records at the Crown Prosecution Service had been destroyed under Starmer's watch. And this is just, you know, almost, I mean, it's quite obvious some sort of very high level cover up at the Crown Prosecution Service took place. And for me, this is kind of the real story, you know, is that how on earth did that happen? And Keir Starmer clearly is involved in this in some way. He can't say that none of these prosecutions had anything to do with him while he was in charge. And he knew nothing about the destruction of all the evidence of these prosecutions as well. It's just, you know, it's not credible. And I think in a way, Boris has been quite clever and the Tories have been clever. First of all, in, I suppose, bigging up Starmer in the first place. As a fearsome opponent, when actually maybe he's, you know, not at all, and the other thing is that, you know, the obvious sort of dog whistle here is that, well, Starmer is accusing Boris of being in charge of Downing Street while all these parties are taking place, when actually it's Dominic Cummings and his chief of staff and other people who are deciding what can and cannot happen. Boris is just running the the show. You know, he's running the country whilst he's not sitting there going through lists of rules saying whether or not a party can take place or not. So he's being very smart, I think, in and the Tories are being very smart in slowly exposing Starmer's role in this whole cover up. Ultimately, how is it that we've got a Crown Prosecution Service that didn't prosecute this major establishment paedophile? And we're supposed to think that this sort of paedophilia in the establishment doesn't take place. And anybody in private eye, if you were to read that, you know, nothing like that takes place. Yeah, this is all conspiracy theory fantasy, where it clearly isn't, because, you know, Alison Levitt is, well, she's now a... I think she's a district judge. She's a very credible figure, and she did quite a good job on that report. And the judiciary are, you know, in that, at least in that case, were doing a very good independent job in uncovering corruption, really, within the Crown Prosecution Service, whilst Keir Starmer was Director of Public Prosecutions. Now, you know, I'm also minded to look at Boris and his time at Oxford and the Bullingdon Club, because there was quite obviously... some people have dirt on Boris too. It's not, there isn't any dirt on him. But anyway, so that's, I think, you know, that's one way of looking at, you know, what's going on today in our politics, is that, you know, there are very tainted figures are supposed to be in charge, and particularly tainted figure running the opposition, which would maybe help explain why there isn't really any opposition.
Yeah, well, I would agree with that, and you know, obviously got a lot more detail than I do at the tip of my tongue to talk about. However, I just have one kind of anecdote that I think I can probably relate, which is you know, when I've had long chats with Martin Bright, who, you know, was the journalist who broke the story about my NSA memo to the Observer. In subsequent, you know, meetings that we've had over the years, and then talks, when we've discussed the issue about these sorts of things, he said that while he was the Home Affairs editor at the Observer, I don't know if it was before or during the time of the inquiry into historical child abuse, or earlier sorts of investigations into this. There was a police, I think he said it was a police whistleblower, who divulged to him that the extent of paedophilia and sort of corruption in the system is so vast that to expose it all would completely collapse the system. So I don't know if there's, you know, if that's absolutely true, but that's the anecdote I have. And you know, that would explain this sort of impossible position they're all in, because if we recall back to the so-called inquiry into the historical child abuse cases, you know, that the actual you know, head of the inquiry changed numerous times because of conflict of interest, and that they weren't in a position to head that inquiry.
Yeah, I would say one thing there, Catherine, and that is that the New Zealand lawyer, senior New Zealand lawyer, who was slated to do that job, I think it was after about 2 months, she decided she couldn't do it because she found that the Home Office, because it was coming out of a Home Office budget, insisted on deciding who her staff could and couldn't be. And she said, well, this is just untenable. I need to be able to decide on my staff. I want to be able to choose my staff, because either the Home Office are implicated in this. The Home Office have, you know, clearly been involved in covering up this for many years. So the idea that the people who are involved in the cover-up choose the staff of the people who are, carrying out the inquiry. So anyway, she packed her bags and left back for New Zealand.
Yeah. And the inquiry ultimately, you know, hasn't produced much of anything. And, you know, the allegation is that credible witnesses were not included. And, you know, the fact that it was all focused on historical abuse and there's no sort of relevance today. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is it's just, it's evil, really. It's evil.
I think it also helps to compare this with what's happened with Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, because, you know, they were clearly running some sort of an operation there where they were inviting rich and powerful people, that they had young men, young women that they could introduce them to, and also that they were, you know, they were filming everything. So they had a little room in the house. I'm not sure if it was the one in New York or whatever. That was at least was definitely proven, which was had a load of cameras. You know, the idea that every room is sound recording and cameras in them.
Right.
So, you know, this is some sort of entrapment operation. But, it, you know, there may be more to it than that, but it certainly
there's
seems
there's blackmail and entrapment, but I believe there is the deeper aspect to it is espionage, potentially, which, you know, is not really explored. And it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, the people that they are sort of set up to be with are not necessarily underage. They may be sort of adults, but their purpose is to, you know, glean information from them as well for espionage activities. So, I mean, it's a combination of things, I think, and it's presumably it's a very tried and tested method, you know, for you know, eons to be able to manipulate people at will.
Yeah, and I think also this is very much involved in people trafficking networks. You know, for example, the BBC presenter Emma Barnett's family were running brothels in Manchester, two brothels run by her father, who was convicted, and her mother, who was also convicted. So the idea here is that, you know, that she's sitting there watching these whores, as she calls them in one of the emails, Emma Barnett's emails, and that she knows that these are trafficked women that are being brought into, you know, to the family's business. And, you know, that sort of thing I find pretty amazing, that somebody like that is then sort of tapped up as a major kind of news presenter or something.
Yeah, I mean, I actually did an interview with her 2 years ago when I was promoting the film, and I had no idea of this background of hers. And I found her, you know, to be quite almost a female version of Paxman. You know, she was, and I think she's being set up as she's being sort of groomed to, you know, it looks like to me anyway, to be sort of quite one of these high powered, highly paid presenters. And I think it was from you, yeah, that I learned about her past. And it's really, it's just, well, it illustrates the fact that these people are, you know, they float to the top, or they're encouraged to the top. But what I was going to say as well, not so, as well as the people trafficking into the sex trade, it's also into the slave trade, essentially. I mean, not that the sex trade isn't slave trade as well, but of the domestic home help sector, of the super rich, you know, where they employ predominantly, you know, a lot of Philippine staff and migrant work. Well, they're not migrant workers; they're trafficked individuals who are literally trapped in these exclusive luxury homes of the elite, and work to their bones, and they're you know, essentially their passports are taken away. They have no means of getting out. And this goes on too as well, which again is all part and parcel of this lifestyle that these people have become so accustomed to and accepting of.
Well, that's supposed to be a crime, isn't it? You know, the modern slavery?
Yes, but, you know, there are still cases, you know, that are uncovered all the time. And people don't, you know, it's this, nobody talks openly about it because you can't accuse anybody of doing that. And if people are trapped in their, in these villas and they never go out, and even if they go out, you know, they're constantly watched and monitored. So how, or they're with somebody else, they're with the children of the family or so on. And so all of these things, it's the same with child trafficking. I saw a post recently where the, you know, people envisage abused child or sexually trafficked child, particularly if they're being trafficked by their own families, you know, to look dreadful, to look like they're, you know, you see them being, you know, grabbed and bundled into cars and that sort of thing. And they said, no, that's not how it happened. You know, we look like we're well cared for. We are, in some respects, very well cared for. You know, we are clothed nicely. We have nice outfits. They take us to fairgrounds and films and cinemas and, you know, amusement arcades. And it's this handover between from the father to somebody else, for example, or from an uncle to somebody else or what have you, that all happens literally in front of people's eyes, and they think nothing of it because this child is well dressed, and there's this kind of apparent, you know, happy atmosphere around them, and so it goes unnoticed. A lot of these things just go unnoticed because they look so common and so ordinary.
Yeah, that I suppose that ordinariness comes from people's fear of simply not having, you know, enough, you know, not having a roof over their head and all sort of thing. So the idea is to make that the norm. So to get rid of any kind of welfare state, social security that protects people, that houses them and feeds them, and that gives them the basics just to keep alive. And the better that the or these sorts of systems of people trafficking only really work when people don't have an option to just walk away.
Right. I think in terms of child trafficking and paedophilia, that happens anyway, regardless of your economic status. But yeah, if you know, they prey on the vulnerable people, especially, and so children in homes and care homes, and you know, children from war-torn countries and from impoverished countries, and young people from those situations as well. So yeah, I mean, it's
I think the care system, it's quite clear to me, in this country for many decades has been a basically a almost a place where any child abusers can get their way in there. They can lure young kids out where there's nobody really checking on what they're doing. The managers of the homes don't really necessarily know whether it's a legitimate friend or a relative or whatever that's taking the kids out. So, you know, it's almost like the cruelty of the carers. By putting someone into care, a young kid into care, that can just be the beginning of a horrific cycle of abuse. And it would be far, far better if the original parents potentially may, you know, say, well, we don't know, with different circumstances for different people. But I mean, for example, I've just been dealing here in Bristol with a case of a 20-year-old single mum who's fallen on hard times. She's homeless. She was evicted. And the first thing that the authorities have done is take her child away. Rather than house her and her child, she's now homeless on the streets with her child in care.
Yeah, and, you know, there's apparently there's a lot of this goes on, and I don't know if it's because there is this sort of bean counting thing going on, in which was, I think, if I'm not mistaken, came in under Blair, where, I may be completely wrong, but correct me if I'm wrong, where the care homes have to prove that they're rescuing X number of children from, you know, broken homes and what have you, and this sort of thing, in order to justify their work. You know, they've got to justify their work, and they've got to ensure that they're, you know, intervening and helping, and so-called quote-unquote helping all of these the X number of families. And if that is the case, then that obviously leads to abuse, because if they've got to ensure that, oh, say, you know, let's say 100 kids are moved into care every quarter or whatever, or rescued, then they've got to fulfill that, and they've got to find them, whether they're, you know, a genuine case or not. And they and it does seem, from what I've heard from other, from personal friends of mine, and also from their contacts, the networks that they've built amongst themselves, they target single parents. They target single parents. They target parents, especially women, because in general, it's the mother who's left being the single parent of the child or children. And they'll look at her, you know, health records, their mental health records, even if those records go back years and are no longer relevant, the mental health issues. They target parents if they have alternative views on healthcare, you know, if they don't wish to give their children the childhood vaccinations. They target them if they, and all of these things count against you. For example, if you choose to homeschool, if you choose not to vaccinate your children, if you refuse, you know, various sorts of medical intervention for your children, or what have you, and all of this type of thing immediately puts you on their radar, and you know, it seems to be a case that they target those families and go after them and take their children off them, even though those children were perfectly happy and well looked after by their parents or parent, you know.
Well, yes, obviously for somebody who's homeless, it's not easy to look after a kid, but hang on, it is possible. And so it's interesting you mentioned that mental health, because in this case, Bristol City Council has decided that it's going to do some sort of mental health assessment on this woman. It's saying, well, because she's homeless, that they believe that she's mentally ill. And I'm not sure of the exact details, and there may be some case to make for it, but the assessment is taking such a long time that they then decided that you know, they better take the child into care in the meantime before they come up. Now, they will say, oh, there's no room at the inn, you know, but I happen to know of other acquaintances in Bristol who've been sectioned for next to nothing and put into a secure unit, you know. So the idea that there's nowhere for her, it just seems to me complete nonsense. So, yeah, this sort of thing is going on. We've got another incident. It's interesting you touch on this subject, Catherine, nearby, very much close to me, where there was a guy who clearly was very mentally ill, living in a housing association scheme, and he started building bonfires in the hallways, and he then set fire to his own flat, and there are various warnings over about a year to the housing association. The guy was arrested at least once previously to the main fire, and then he's nearly killed all of his residents. Now, the police weren't able to detain the guy because of the mental health issues, supposedly, and the Crown Prosecution Service decided not to prosecute him for arson because of mental health. So you know, there's definitely, I think, a complete failure and breakdown around here in the whole mental health social services sector. And they will use the excuse, oh, well, we've got nowhere to put people. But hang on a minute. You know, the in combination with the Crown Prosecution Service, what's happening is, as mentally ill people are committing crimes, they are just being let off. And this guy, this arsonist, is seen by one of my neighbours just drinking and having a laugh down the local pub a couple of days after his, because the police weren't able to keep him for more than 24 hours. So, you know, there's some serious problems with the mentally ill. And it's almost as if being mentally ill is, you know, if you're really mentally ill, is an excuse to just carry on and do whatever it is you want to do and come to the authorities' attention maybe time and time again.
Yeah, well, it's definitely not something that I've really focused or been all that aware of. But, you know, I mean, was it not under Blair government that they brought in the whole care in the community approach?
And well, hang on, no.
Or was it under the Tory and Lib Tory coalition?
Yeah, it was Victoria. Oh gosh, Virginia Bottomley, the major government. Care in the community. So. Yeah, I mean, it did take several years to basically shut down mental institutions. I mean, care in the community quite clearly is not care.
It doesn't work.
It's the idea is, well, we're just going to close the mental homes. And, you know, it's funny because we, back in 1999, I mean, a bunch of activists went and squatted in Norwich, an old mental hospital. And it was the most beautiful place. And we got some publicity in the Norwich newspapers about it. And over a week or so, or a couple of weeks that we were there, I say we squatted it. We basically just camped outside it and just to draw attention to this waste of public land and public facilities. And every single piece of glass in the building had been smashed. We got told that someone got paid to do that. So, and then, of course, the land is sold for housing. But the point being is that we got, well, I'd say between sort of 20 and 30 people came to visit us while we were there who were at the mental hospital when it was a mental hospital and said, oh, well, you know, this place really saved me at a difficult time, you know, because we were cared for, we were looked after by brilliant staff. And there was some lovely grounds here. And that has all gone. I mean, there's nothing like that anymore. As far as I can tell, certainly nothing which is, you know, really helps people. I mean, people are incarcerated in these secure units, but there's certainly nowhere they can just sort of enjoy the countryside, walk around or whatever. And yes, they are fed, but it's a completely different system. And the idea is as soon as they can get away with it, you're just sent back and, you know, told to get on with things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's just symptomatic of this, you know, public-private partnership that has gone mainstream and it is basically the main, you know, it's the arteries and the veins of the whole system now. So the concept of social care, the true meaning of it, which, you know, ultimately, if you're doing it in a local level, it would be community care, because you'd be employing people from the community in those establishments where people are, you know, being cared for, whether it's mental health or whether it's long-term, you know, recuperation from illness. You know, and back in the day, like years gone by, there were sanatoria, you know, that were situated in, and maybe it was only for the super rich, but maybe they also had sanatoria for, you know, the working classes and the middle classes. But the idea that you need time to recover from any number of illnesses and even the number of days that, you know, people recovered in hospital have been vastly reduced. And they keep talking about the fact that they're cutting back the days that people stay in hospital. They claim because it's, you know, the improvement in services and so on, but it's all about efficiency and the high turnover of patients and the fact that they've radically reduced the number of beds in hospitals as well. But, you know, it was routine for new mothers who'd just given birth to recuperate in hospital for 3 days, you know, or longer even. You know, they stayed in bed and they were brought nourishing food and their baby was in a cot beside them or whatever. And so they had that, you know, initial 3 days to just kind of take a breath and relax and get over the fact that they've just brought a new human being into the world. And all of that now is just, you know, it's just right. You've had your baby now, out you go back home, cope on your own.
Production line.
Exactly.
We're charting a sort of decline here, Catherine, in moral standards, in basic physical standards, in human rights. This is very important. I think that, you know, you've got to have as a the Universal Charter of Human Rights talks about the right to shelter, the right to food. Well, what about some of the people here in Bristol just simply have no right to food? They have to go and beg it, etc. These rights have all been eroded. And I think probably one of the most important accelerations of that was the bailouts in 2008. I look around me and I see, you know, the complete impoverishment, for example, of our local authority here in Bristol City Council. All the services have been pared right back to the bare minimum, and they've just had to go to the lawyers and say, well, what are our statutory duties? What do we absolutely have to do? And can we get away, for example, with closing the entire anti-vermin operation, you know, so they've closed that, you know, everything that they used to do. The libraries, they have to keep open because of the people that still don't have internet access have to go and use the internet in the libraries. So there are, you know, it's really the absolute bare minimum. And this, yeah, I think, is largely, you know, due to the massive shift that happened in 2008. And of course, also in 2019, where there's more bailouts, which were much quieter bailouts of the banks, putting the entire nation into debt in a similar way to, you know, Klaus Schwab is desiring that everybody should be in debt. Therefore, they don't have any property, but they can still somehow be happy.
Yeah, this whole, as you say, the great impoverishment, you know, the massive transfer of wealth upwards, and the gradual and, well, it's fairly rapid reduction of wealth and resources for the vast majority, it is accelerating. I mean, the cost of energy, it's happening pretty much across the globe, I think, this increase in energy prices. Ours have doubled here in Turkey, and they keep doubling. And I know that they are doubling in the UK, apparently. You know, my husband filled the car up, and, well, he couldn't fill the tank up because this amount of money that it took to fill up the tank 6 months ago barely fills it halfway up now. So this whole process is baked in. You know, this is not an accident, is it? It's deliberate. And the ultimate aim of it is to defraud everyone of their possessions eventually. And everybody will be in such dire straits that they will be grateful for the universal basic income. You know, they'll see it as a godsend and a good thing, but it will be tied to all sorts of, apps that will track everything you do, and it will be a social credit system.
Yeah, well, I mean, look at the situation in Nazi Germany in the 1930s when there was, terrible mass unemployment, poverty, runaway inflation. Everyone welcomed Hitler with open arms.
Yeah, because, you know, he brought sort of a feeling of hope and revival, and you know, he could, and he united people in pointing their fingers towards you know, an enemy that they could blame for all their ills. You know, it's a
Yeah, but
classic.
I mean, the point also there is that, of course, things started actually getting better, almost like returning to normal. And so, you know, he was greeted almost like as a sort of messiah figure. And what bothers me now is that we've got, I mean, you know, with the energy price increases, you know, blatantly, Shell are saying, oh, well, we've got 14 times greater profits than the last quarter at Shell. They're quite happily rubbing their hands. And it's quite clear the government seems to be completely powerless to do anything about this. So they've jacked up the price of fuel here and gas, and they're basically destroying the regulation of those prices at the same time. And it's quite clear there's a message going out to anybody, you know, with half a brain cell, which is who's in charge here? Well, the Shells and the BPs are in charge, the oil cartel's in charge, and they even had the cheek to create an artificial fuel shortage at the time of the party conference season to send a message to them. You know, because there was some excuse used that, oh, well, we don't have enough drivers. I mean, it's quite obvious that the profitability of these oil companies means that they can employ as many drivers as they want. There's all sorts of drivers that will come over and start working for them from other industries, if they wanted it to. So it was an artificially created, I have no doubt whatsoever that was an artificially created shortage back in September, October 2021, to send a message to the politicians and to anyone who was watching that the oil companies are actually running the show.
They're running. Yeah, they're not the only ones. I mean, all corporations, private corporations, they know that, you know, the governments have basically rolled over each time, bailed them out whenever they needed it, and so, you know, they know that they can get what they want. You know, they just need to threaten to pull out, or to, you know, to withhold services or what have you, and Bob's your uncle. So what do you think? Do you think people are gradually becoming more aware of this reality now? I mean, I just came across this concept of the different levels of consciousness. And I think it, you know, it's quite illustrative of it's quite comparable to the mass psychosis theory, the fact that, you know, certain numbers of people are susceptible to hypnosis. And there is this overlap for me of those people and the levels of consciousness. So in this idea of consciousness, you begin by being, or everyone more or less starts off being in what's described as the consensus consciousness. So the consensus consciousness takes up about 70 to 80% of the population. It's the vast majority, which is why they keep using this terminology when it comes to science, you know, even though that's an oxymoron, but they talk about the fact that it's consensus on science. And so that level of consciousness doesn't allow you to question that consensus, you just accept it. And for each, you know, individual, that you may be at various stages of consensus consciousness, because you may agree on some levels with some things, but not on others. But somebody who basically agrees with every subject is with the consensus, they're basically a person with no self-awareness. They're completely programmed, and, you know, and so the vast majority of, well, say 30 to 40% of those, I would say, are the ones that are susceptible to hypnosis as well. So they're completely trapped in this in this psychosis or this mass formation that has been described. But then under the mass formation model, there's also another 30 to 40% who, although they don't become hypnotized, they don't fall under the spell, but they do, however, go along with the consensus because they don't want to rock the boat. So that basically equates to the sort of 75 to 80% of people who form the consensus view of consciousness. The next level of consciousness, if you can get out of that, is to become individuated. And so around 20% of people are in that category. So they're able to think for themselves and they can, you know, question where the consensus view comes from, why they have these beliefs, you know, where do they come from, what does it mean, and so on. And finally, there are approximately 2% of the population at any time who achieve spiritual consciousness. And, you know, that so that's much, much rarer. And I think that the number of people who, I mean, I'm not saying they're literally the people who are actively standing up and resisting. So I wouldn't equate those two categories of people, but I would argue that it's maybe 2% of the population that is actively opposing, you know. So although in the mass formation model, there's about 20% who do not go along with the hypnosis and they reject the narrative. But of that, I think it's something like 2% who physically stand up and, you know, speak truth against power, and they refuse to go along with the mandates, and they resign from their jobs or they wait till they're sacked. You know, just recently I saw a video of a chap who was a Canadian Mountie for about 15 years or more, and he was actually one of the personal bodyguards of Trudeau. And he's resigned because he cannot go along anymore with what's going on. So, you know, yeah. So that's a concept that that I recently came across. And I would say, you know, because the mass majority of people are in this consensus consciousness, it's a very gradual process for people to find themselves moving out of that and into individuated consciousness. And I was in that consensus mode for, I would say, most of my life. You know, apart from maybe on some issues, and of course, when it came to the Iraq War, I was part of the opposition to that. But, you know, with the allopathic medical paradigm, I was definitely in the consensus mode for a very long time, right up until about 10 years ago, where I started to question, you know, what was going on with the allopathic model and the whole vaccine theory and so on. So,
yeah, I mean, my own experience, I think, echoes that, Catherine. I think, you know, I don't know if you want to just explain what you mean first by this term allopathic.
Well, the allopathic model is based on this. Basically, it's the Rockefeller model of medicine, basically. When petroleum was discovered, when oil was discovered, when they started to, you know, use refined petroleum for all kinds of other chemical processes, they discovered that they could make synthetic compounds and eventually pharmaceutical products, which they could use as a medical treatment. And so the Rockefellers and all those great sort of industrial titans in the early 20th century or late 20th century, they ensured that they would have control over this new medical paradigm. So this concept of your body being at war with pathogens, and that, you know, your body is literally just a kind of odd, a kind of random assortment of cells and organs and tissues and bone, a kind of mechanical thing, and that, you know, it's completely susceptible to all manner of external pathogens, and that, you know, it has to be treated, those symptoms have to be suppressed. That, to me, is what the allopathic model has been and still is to this day. It's about suppressing symptoms and not really trying to find the root cause of problems, just masking the symptoms.
I think at this point it could be good to mention Dr. Vernon Coleman, who has been such a breath of fresh air. He was a GP for many years, I think, in Birmingham. In fact, there's even old footage of him on the TV campaigning as a GP against the system, because he's more concerned for his patients than he was for his job, even in those days. And his book is, well, one of his books, one of the first ones I came across in the 1990s, is called How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You. And, you know, he's coming from, and of course he had a column in the Daily Express for many years. Now he's completely shut out of the mass media, and his opinions apparently have no value, you know, to the mass media. And yet he's making a tremendous amount of points about the lying that's been going on, and he's done a terrific job. But, you know, the point here being that he has understood that much of what he is being coerced to do by the GP system, by the pharmaceutical industry, even by the Department for Health, is not, as a GP, is not actually helping people. I don't think you need to be a genius to work out that, you know, to fix a car, you don't just try and put a sticking plaster on whatever's wrong. You try and figure out what's wrong with it. Now, of course, that these days is almost an impossible thing to do, and that seems to be, I think you're quite right, Catherine, because if you're just dealing with symptoms rather than causes and origins, then you have a money making exercise, you know, whatever it is, that the problem will continue, and whoever it is will have to come back for more. In a way, what you're talking about here is about this whole system of renting everything rather than owning stuff, because, you know, if you're not able to get to the root causes of things are constantly going wrong. And so, you know, you are going to be, your asset is going to be destroyed and eroded. Whereas if you're renting it, it's someone else's responsibility to keep it going. So this is all kind of tied into that. But I wanted to go back briefly and see what you make of this, to your talk, your idea of this sort of 70 to 80% consensus, et cetera, of the population. Back to Wilhelm Reich, who wrote in the 1930s, one of his, I think, most pertinent books was this Mass Psychology of Fascism. And I've just got a Pelican copy of it here, reading out from the back. Writing in the years 1930 to 33, which is just as the Nazi Party was coming to power, Reich applies his theories on human character structure to dissecting and analysing what he realised was a menacing social situation. Fascism, he argues, does not spring exclusively either from economic factors or from the activities of political leaders. Much rather, it's a collective expression of average human beings whose primary biological needs have been ruthlessly crushed by an authoritarian society. Any form of organized mysticism, and this is where the religion of COVID sort of comes in here, feeds on the longings of the masses, he concludes, and we must be forced to realize its potential destructiveness. So this is from 1932, this was published. It seems we've forgotten all about that. You know, the only things really that we've got to rely on in the situation where the state and the mass media and the financial system is got this kind of new mysticism, which is working against us, are things like church and family is the only things we've got to hold on to.
Yeah, and I would argue that at the moment, the church isn't doing much, if anything at all, to expose this consensus, because they're still advocating for people to wear masks when they come to service or even to be vaccinated. You know, so they haven't stood up.
Well, some are.
Just
as a sort of little breath of fresh air, I went to a Baptist chapel a few weeks ago where nobody had been vaccinated at all.
Ah, maybe that has something to do with, perhaps links with aborted tissues or something for Baptists specifically. I don't know.
Well, I think it's more that they're a nonconformist. You know, they very much see themselves as, we are an independent group. We don't, we're following Christ rather than, any kind of organized, faith or establishment church.
Well, I also saw a quote today, which is apparently from Machiavelli. So that goes a bit further back than the 30s. But it says, "For the great majority of mankind are satisfied with appearances, as though they were realities, and are often more influenced by the things that seem than by those that are." So, it's this question of what appears to be real versus what is real. And I think, for me, in order to expose the consensus, for its fallacies, you've got to eventually come to accept some things. So your analogy that, the body is like a car and you don't just stick, super glue the car together if it's broken. That analogy is used a lot about car, putting the right kind of fuel in your car and, equates to what you feed yourself, what you eat. But as human beings, we are not just mechanical beings, are we? We're completely superior to mechanical beings on every single level. And it's the fact that in the allopathic model, they actually don't consider that. They don't consider the human body as being anything more than just a sort of collection of mechanical things,
No, I mean, I can remember, Catherine, sorry to interrupt you, but chatting to my doctor about fasting, as a potential part of a cure for some ailment I had. Well, I mean, he was just gobsmacked. This does not compute, and yet, maybe having nothing to eat for a few days can do a hell of a lot to clear toxins out of your system. And it just shocks me that the general GPs nowadays have got just no consciousness of this.
No, and so this is the thing. This is the crucial thing. And what's interesting for me is that, there's a growing, it's still very small, but there seems to be a growing movement and the numbers of people who are beginning to align themselves to this concept that we are so much more than just a collection of, mechanical body parts. And that in order to be healthy and to be well, that you have to look after yourself. And so it's this concept now, which is still not really available for discussion in the mainstream media. But the difference between germ theory and terrain theory. And so I was quite surprised to see that last week in the coronavirus committee that has been organized by Rainer Fulmich in Germany, they actually invited Dr. Andrew Kaufman and Dr. Stephen Lanka to discuss their views of germ theory or viral theory. And in the committee room, there was Rainer Fulmich and the other, I forgot her name, the lady that works with him, the lawyer, and Dr. Wolfgang Wodarg, who early on in our talks was one of the doctors of the week that you talked about. So Dr. Wodarg obviously has been, has spent his whole life's work on, in this allopathic paradigm, right? And, you know, although he doesn't think that he thinks that this whole corona scam is identical, but on a much larger scale of the previous SARS, the SARS-CoV-1, you know, the scam back then that he helped to expose.
I thought he was a swine flu guy.
Wodarg.
Yeah.
Yeah, wasn't that the SARS-CoV-1? Or was that
I don't think so, no. I don't think so. That was, I think SARS-CoV-1 was confined to Asia and was relatively small, whereas the swine flu thing was supposed to be, you know, kind of much wider Western, you know. But yeah, but you're absolutely right. He made sure that the initial injuries due to the vaccine were picked up very, very quickly and the vaccine was stopped.
Well, and also he called out the fact that there were, you know, all these cases, the whole, they started with that cases nonsense. And it was this whole business of these faulty tests that were generating all these cases. But nevertheless, so in this discussion, well, it was a presentation basically by Dr. Kaufman and Dr. Stephen Lanka. Dr. Kaufman is he initially started off as a psychiatrist and he became disenfranchised with the way psychiatry dealt with patients. And so he moved away from the conventional model, I think. I don't know a great deal about that. Dr. Lanka himself was formerly a virologist, but he now pretty much, he doesn't like to refer to himself as a virologist. He's a historian of virology, and he is probably better characterized as a microbiologist. Anyway, they set out to explain terrain theory. And so they described how virologists, how they go about identifying viruses, and they explained in detail how this works, and they basically exposed historical research and publications about viruses as being invalid because of the research methods that they used. And Dr. Lanka himself has actually conducted control experiments now, which should have been done. You know, the control experiments always should be done when you're doing initial studies, because, you know, how else can you disprove your own theory if you don't do control experiments? But they have not been done in the past, apparently, to determine whether viruses exist or not. And so he conducted the very same types, the exact same processes that virologists use to determine if there is a virus. And basically what they do is they take a tissue sample from a poorly person whether from their, you know, nose, lungs, or blood, or what have you. And then they stabilize those cell, that cell tissue culture, because obviously you've got to ensure that it stays alive outside the body. So they stabilize it with nutrients, and then gradually over days they start to reduce the nutrients to this cell culture, so that eventually it's starving. It's deprived of nutrients, and the cell culture is essentially starving. Then they apply a variety of antibiotics in an effort, apparently, to destroy any bacteria within the cell culture. And then it is their premise that what remains, if the cells die, is evidence of viral activity, and that a virus is present. So, you know, they apply this cytotoxic combination of antibiotics to these starved tissue cells. They die, and then they use that as the basis for their claim that a virus is present. So Dr. Lenka did the same experiments. He took tissue samples from healthy people. Presumably, he also had to prove that they were PCR negative. And the exact same thing occurred. Those healthy cell tissues that were not from a sick person, they died after the process that was applied to them. So Dr. Kaufman and Dr. Lenka explained all of this, and they discussed how all the previous existence to viruses are on very tenuous grounds. They have very low thresholds of evidentiary proof. And, you know, and so they basically wanted to discuss this. However, Dr. Wodak was quite uncomfortable with this, with their statements. And he literally couldn't seem to comprehend. And eventually, I mean, there were some quite tense, uncomfortable moments of discussion. But eventually, his only argument seemed to be, well, in that case, what makes people ill? That was his response. And Dr. Kaufman and Dr. Lenka said, well, that's not for us to argue here. We're not arguing about what makes people ill. We're simply trying to say that, you know, there is no hard empirical evidence for infectious pathological viruses, and so it basically came to a impasse, and so it ended. But the day after that presentation, I watched Dr. Kaufman's a collaborative premiere of their new film, new documentary film, which came out last Saturday, the first part of it. The second part of it is coming out this Saturday, where they talk about this, and the film is called Terrain. And so this is all about the alternative view. So this is not the consensus view now. This is alternative view of health. And it's the idea that terrain refers to our bodies, how we treat them, how we treat ourselves, how we eat, how we sleep, how we exercise, but also external factors like stresses and emotional traumas and so on, psychological aspects as well as physical aspects to health and well-being. and the possibility of poisonings and toxicities. Now, this is an aspect that is never discussed in the mainstream, because it would, you know, you could then point the finger at specific producers of toxins and poisoning.
Well, I mean, I think there is a bit of chat about that sort of thing, toxic environment, you know. But look, I mean, the main point to make with Wodarg and Kaufman, the sort of divide there, is none of this really disproves the existence of viruses.
What do you mean it doesn't prove?
Well, I mean, there can be viruses can be part of the mix. Why is what Kaufman's saying any evidence that viruses don't exist? I mean, you know, they're just another thing in the mix, just as other sorts of toxins might well be in your body.
Well, but what they're trying to say is that there has never been proof of the existence of viruses. So they, you know, basically they pull apart the proof of the existence of HIV, and that's been done before. That has been done years ago, where they've disproved that HIV caused AIDS. In fact, AIDS, it is simply an umbrella term for all manner of symptoms that are caused by any number of things, and the same exact thing could be applied to COVID-19. You know, they simply come up with the theory that SARS-CoV-2 is the cause of COVID-19, but COVID-19 is an umbrella category for all, and they keep adding X number of pathologies or symptoms to COVID-19, even though those same pathologies could be vaccine-induced. You know, so now you're beginning to see myocarditis and various things being added potentially to the symptom list of COVID-19, even though that has actually been linked with the vaccines, as is said, to prevent you from getting.
Well, no, I understand that, but I'm sure you can, you would agree that many millions of people who bothered to look into this would agree that particularly these COVID vaccines are far more dangerous than the original virus was.
Right. And, you know, so they're arguing that in order to, you know, I've come to this position over time. As I say, I didn't arrive at this position overnight. I myself had an HIV test before I got married. You know, me and my husband, we both went to the clinic and did all the blood tests for all the various sexually transmitted diseases, because we wanted to be sure before we got married, you know, that we weren't going to bring any sort of lifelong disease into our relationship. Thank God we didn't, either of us, test positive, because at that time, you know, I may well have been talked into, or he may have been talked into, taking a toxic combination of drugs, which have been developed since the mid-80s, to treat something, even though you have no symptoms.
No,
simply a positive test.
No, I understand, but hang on, how can you even rely on the test that you got?
Exactly, but back then I had no idea, right? I was part of the consensus view then that I was doing the right thing by having these tests, you know, because that would, it was proof to me that I had a clean bill of health. I did, however, take a hepatitis B vaccine, because they claimed that my husband had shown signs of being, as they described it, a low risk carrier of hepatitis B. So I accepted the vaccine. I didn't question it. I took it. They tested my blood afterwards and said, well, you aren't showing any antibodies for hepatitis B, so we suggest that you have the jab again.
Oh, God. Well, this is enough to make you an anti-vaxxer, isn't it?
Well, at the time, well, it didn't turn me then. But however, I decided, you know, there was no point having another jab if the first one didn't work. Later on, much later on, I met somebody here in Turkey, an English woman, and we were discussing this for some reason. And she claimed that she had five hepatitis B jabs because she never, after each one, never developed any sort of antibody to it. I was just gobsmacked. You know, I didn't say anything, but I was completely dumbfounded that she allowed herself to have five hepatitis B jabs because actually they're quite toxic. They have very high loads of aluminium. And nevertheless, she's also somebody who's gone ahead and had the COVID jab. Not only that, she's had the boosters. So she's had about four jabs. So clearly she hasn't moved away from this consensus consciousness. She's still deeply embedded in it.
Well, I mean, it's a sort of matter of faith, isn't it, really? In which you have faith that somebody else knows better than you do, and you're abrogating your responsibility over your own body. It's quite incredible. I mean, the idea that you would just keep having vaccine after vaccine after vaccine, even though they weren't working, you know, surely at some point people would think, well, that's not necessarily a good idea. And, you know, back again to Dr. Vernon Coleman, how to stop your doctor killing you.
Right. Exactly. So my awareness still didn't reach the point where I began to become individuated until after my daughter was born, after I took her, sadly, I regret this very much so, but you know, she had all her baby jabs up until and including the first MMR jab. And, you know, within the first 3 months of her having the first initial baby jabs, she developed a rash on her neck. And she'd also gained a lot of weight from birth because she was exclusively breastfed. And because she'd gained weight, she started developing a double chin. So I thought that, you know, her rash around her neck was maybe because of heat, a sort of heat rash. Anyway, it eventually spread all over her face. She had this red inflamed skin on her cheeks. I took her to the doctors. They said, oh, you know, you should have brought her much sooner. This is sort of inflamed, sort of eczema. And, you know, we're going to prescribe some mild anti-steroidal creams. Well, I was reluctant to apply those creams, but, you know, the doctor seemed to be telling me that it was very normal. You know, I was quite astonished that, you know, soft baby skin, you know, a baby that was exclusively breastfed, what would trigger this inflammation of the skin? But the doctor seemed to claim that this was a perfectly normal, very commonplace thing that babies experience. Now, once again, looking back, that's evidence to me of the normalization of vaccine injury. And, you know, we're seeing that again now in the COVID era about normalizing heart attacks. We've seen numerous examples of that being, you know, in the media, in the press of, you know, if you do this, you're raising your chances of heart attack and so on, as if. And that dreadful, as Stella was saying last week, that dreadful advert that was produced by British Heart Foundation about that female soccer player, football player collapsing on the field. You know, that sort of fear tactic and normalizing vaccine injury. It happened previously in just narrow sections of society. So in the height of the AIDS era, it was exclusively, well, more or less exclusively in the sort of gay community and the people who had kind of excess high numbers of sexual partners and in the drug scene and so on. You know, they were being, they were experiencing this kind of absurd situation where despite being healthy, they were testing positive and then they were prescribed these what have now become lifelong daily doses of highly toxic drug combinations, which, you know, produce any number of side effects, which are then treated with other drug combinations to suppress those symptoms and so on. But it was exclusively that category of people that experienced it. And then in the childhood vaccine injuries, you know, again, it's exclusively the parents of those children, if they're able to accept that a vaccine injured their child. And then, you know, finally now it's rolled out to the whole population. And I think this is much more challenging now because every sector of society is now witnessing how, you know, the cure is far, 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 far worse than the disease itself. If indeed that disease is one thing.
Well, every sector, that is, apart from those glued to their TV sets.
Yeah, but, you know, they still mix with other people, don't they, on the whole? And so they will still hear, whether they acknowledge it or not, that so-and-so died, who dropped dead, you know, and they were perfectly healthy, you know, or so-and-so is now, you know, disabled, or so-and-so is suddenly had a stroke, or, you know, any number of, it will begin to filter into their lived experience.
Well, I hope so. Just to let you know, we had a fascinating guest on a few years ago, Jasper Tomlinson, who he had an incredible career through various sectors, and he ended up working with this company that was pushing molten salt reactors, and he managed to get quite a substantial grant from the government's innovation scheme to develop the idea of these different, you know, particular, apparently very unpolluting type of nuclear reactor. And we did an interview with him a couple of years ago. I was speaking to his wife this week. He passed away last year just after having his COVID vaccine. So another one, you know. Yeah. So there's a lot of this out there. She was certainly in no position to make any kind of entry on the VAERS system for her husband's death. And, you know, just one of those people who's kind of fallen off the statistics, but nevertheless died after having the vaccine.
Yeah, I mean, it's so tragic. It's so very sad. And the numbers, alarming though they are still not, you know, not being fully recorded. So for me, again, I come back to, and I know you say that, you know, what Andrew Kaufman and Stephen Lenker and all these, Tom Cowan and all these doctors on the sort of periphery are trying to convince people of, that there is no evidence of infectious pathological viruses. I personally have got to the position now where I agree with them, and I think the only way that we can actually take down this currently really poisonous allopathic pharmaceutical model is if we really do scrutinize and really do, you know, humbly accept that there is quite conceivably the potential that terrain model or terrain theory is the real theory or more accurate model of how the body works versus germ theory. And until and unless we reach that consensus view, we will be prey to another potential pandemic, you know, that is completely a mass formation hoax. You know, just as I think AIDS was, you know, it will just carry on, this biotechnical totalitarian system will succeed if we do not come to a different understanding of our whole biological systems and what real health means.
Well, I think there's still definitely a question there, though, about this, because what you're saying about this, no virus theory does rather shut out some of the people. I mean, I think it's quite important to look at people, particularly who were very active in this field, criticizing the pharmaceutical industry and vaccines before, 2019. I'm talking about, Mike Yeadon. I mean, what about the Vernon Colmans? What
Mike
about
Yeadon Mike Yeadon himself, though, is already, he's acknowledged that he's not convinced, he's on the fence about whether a virus exists or not.
Yeah, and Wodarg, for example, Stanley Laham, our correspondent here, people like Andrew Wakefield, Del Bigtree, people that have been campaigning on this for many years, this does rather undercut and undermine their work.
Well, yes and no. I mean, what they do is important because, again, there's a vast majority of the consensus view who are not ready yet to accept that there is no such thing as an infectious pathological virus. However, I personally think it's not fair to exclude them and to say that they're shills or whatever, or that they're, controlled op. I mean, that's erroneous, I believe, and it's dangerous to fall into that sort of them and us.
But I mean, it's a bit of a rabbit hole, which does rather suit the Peter Daszaks and the, people who've been digging up information about, a SARS and AIDS implants into a virus over in Wuhan. So it could definitely still be seen as something which is undermining getting to the bottom of this and actually prosecuting people responsible for creating a man-made virus which was designed, to be rolled out across the world, and treatment protocols brought into place which would almost certainly kill people. In other words, not treating them at all, number one, and number two, when they do end up very, very sick in hospital, treating them as if they've got pneumonia, where actually they've got SARS and they need a completely different form of treatment, actually a very simple treatment like chloroquine or ivermectin.
Well, yeah, I can see that, but I don't think you need to have proof of any sort of, whether it's man-made or whether it's wild-type virus, to prove that these people have, been guilty of criminal intent. Because, there's any number of, you can simply accuse them of not following their original public health protocols, of establishing completely, completely obscure and previously utterly discounted public health protocols, such as the mass lockdown of healthy people, and and even John Hopkins' meta study recently that came out proving that lockdowns and all of the sort of non-pharmaceutical approaches had no effect. They had virtually no effect whatsoever on the course of the illness in each country, and hospitalizations and so on. But furthermore, Dennis Rancor's research seems to suggest, meta-studies, seems to suggest quite clearly that, in fact, the lockdowns were harmful, and the spikes that occurred, the spikes in mortality that occurred, can be specifically pinned down to the start of any declared lockdown.
Well, there was also this kind of self-inflicted lockdown as well, which hasn't really been, I don't think, pulled apart enough, which was a perfectly reasonable assumption of people that were sick, that they would simply not go to the doctor, definitely not go anywhere near a hospital A&E department, simply for the fear of catching COVID, which is quite a reasonable thing to do. But that also is going to have a massive knock-on effect, as we saw.
Right. And so these people who were terrified, basically. And so this you know, this can also, because, and I think this is being addressed, you know, because psychiatrists have written now, submitted a letter of complaint to Public Health England or the Department of Health and Social Care that their campaign of fear has had such a negative effect, and their use of, you know, the nudge unit, the psychological manipulation, the behavioral management of the entire population of the country is totally unacceptable. It is completely unethical and immoral. And, you know, it could be argued that it resulted in death. So it, you know, they'd be guilty of manslaughter, or death by, I don't know what the various categories of can be associated with it, but people literally
murder.
Literally,
how about murder?
Well, I mean, there is accusations of murder because of the toxic cocktails of midazolam and remdesivir and opioids in, you know, people who didn't require those sorts of drugs.
Yeah, and people who did require water but weren't given it.
Right, right. So this, you know, the infamous Liverpool care pathway that was supposedly ended apparently hasn't. You know, it has been going on surreptitiously since it was exposed in 2014. And it's been rolled out on a massive scale, you know, in the last 2 years. So, you know, all of this, I think, is eventually going to come out in the wash, as we say. And but the damage has been done, you know. And in the meantime, all of these totalitarian legislative infrastructure, the enabling acts for the totalitarian state, are being brought in under this under the guise of all these medical measures.
Yeah, I'm sure the Chinese Communist Party and Jacinda Ardern, if they were on this call, would be arguing that actually the lockdowns of the zero COVID policy caused almost no excess deaths in those countries, Catherine.
Well, you know, if they're not counting the people who die from depression, from suicides, from, you know, untreated medical problems, you know, then of course they think it's a success. But the reality is, I think in New Zealand, I haven't looked at the figures, but just like in Taiwan, I would argue that the people who have now died from vaccine injury, if those figures are verified and you know, published, they would exceed the number of people who've actually died from, supposedly, from or with COVID in New Zealand.
Yeah, okay, well, I suppose this debate about viruses existing is sort of at the core of a lot of this. So can you just remind us of the, if people want to follow that, where to look on Saturday to find the second part of this film that's coming out?
Just a sec. It's Andrew Kaufman. Let me see if I can find...
I mean, let me be quite clear. I mean, I see him as a sort of David Icke plant. You know, I wouldn't, you know, include his analysis at all, because it seems to undermine everything that most of the, you know, voraciously brilliant doctors have been saying for the last couple of years. So, you know, he just seems to me, I would even bring an analogy with something like the no planes theory on the September the 11th attacks, because this kind of was introduced into the discussion about what happened on 9/11 and ended up being, you know, various quite high profile people picked it up, such as the former MI5 guy, David Shaler. And then, you know, it was used to discredit the entire movement. And I'm particularly concerned because of the, you know, the whole list of people that don't subscribe to this theory, such as Vernon Coleman, Mike Needham, Wolfgang Wodarg, our very own Stanley Laham, I'm sure has had nothing to do with it. And some of the main campaigners around the world, such as Wakefield and Del Bigtree.
Yeah, you know, I know. I don't think that's the case. I think, you know, this theory is not new. It goes back to right to the very dawn of the germ theory, Louis Pasteur and his colleague. And there are books about how Louis Pasteur was a plagiarist, and that on his deathbed he allegedly said that he was wrong and that his colleague Beauchamp was right. Antoine Beauchamp, who, you know, nobody has heard of, but he proposed the theory of the terrain theory, the terrain is everything. And on his deathbed, Louis Pasteur allegedly said, you're right, my friend, terrain is everything. So
yeah,
this
but
is
then
not...
Neil Armstrong allegedly said when he landed on the moon, oh my God, it rings like a bell, and that it's a hollow metal spaceship, you know. So, you know, there are all sorts of accusations around. Anyway, I think it'd be really interesting to watch this. So where can we watch it and where can we find it?
Well, the website is called terrainthefilm, all one word, .com.
Okay, Catherine Gunn, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. Until next time.